This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Gannett and Gatehouse announced a merger this week. Gannett's newspapers include USA Today and Florida Today, while Gatehouse papers include the Florida Times Union and the Palm Beach Post. The deal would create a newspaper giant with a circulation of 8.7 million, and the aim is to combat declining ad revenue and circulation. So where does that leave newspapers in Florida, the journalists who report the news, and the people who read it? Today we're digging into the fine print of the merger, what it means for the news business, and we're taking your calls. Well, joining us in the studio, Rick Brunson, Associate Instructor of Journalism at UCF. Rick, thank you so much for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
We're also joined by Sarah Fisher. She is a media reporter for Axios. Thank you, Sarah.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Rick Edmonds is a media business analyst with Pointer. Thank you so much, Rick.
Yeah, hi. Good to be with you, Matthew.
You can join the conversation, too. Where do you get your news? A newspaper subscription, online news, television, radio, all of the above? What value do you place on news, and how do you pay for it? And what do you think this merger means for you as a news consumer? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can also reach out to us online. Our Twitter handle is at WMFE Orlando. Well, Sarah, I want to start with you. This will create a truly colossal newspaper company. Just remind us of the numbers. How many papers are we talking about, in effect?
Oh, we're talking about a lot of papers. So when you think about what the chain would own if it were to be combined, it would be about one in every six papers would be owned by this combined company. That's over 200 daily newspapers, and then there's hundreds of weeklies that are also included in that. To date, the next biggest media company, newspaper company that would come up next to it is McClatchy, and they are significantly behind that number of circulation. So we're talking about really one big dominant player if these two newspaper chains were to combine.
It's not the first time, obviously, that you know a couple of big companies have merged in the news business. Is there anything comparable, if not, in the newspaper business and other media?
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at what the FCC under the Trump administration has been doing. They've been deregulating legacy news and communications industries just so that they can better compete with the big tech companies like Google and Facebook. So you see a lot of local broadcast companies consolidating. You see also, honestly, a lot of local radio companies are consolidating. It's a matter of coming up with enough scale so that you can leverage resources to be able to better drive profit in a news environment that does not really favor small companies.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking with our panel of experts about the big merger that was announced this week between Gannett and Gatehouse and what that means for news consumers and news producers as well, what it means for you, where you get your news from, and how that could change once this merger, when and if it goes through. So, Rick Brunson, I want to just bring you into this conversation because you have a prop with you. It's a brick. Just explain what you want to do with this brick. What's it about?
Yeah, I'm a teacher, so you always have a visual, right? So this is a brick. How's that for a NAT sound pop?
Nice.
This is a brick from what is left of the old Tampa Tribune building where I spent 10 years of my journalism career. Over in the Tampa Bay area. And the Trib was bought in 2012 by a private equity firm called Revolution Capital. And they eventually sold the newspaper itself to the Tampa Bay Times. But they also sold the building that the paper was housed in and the property it was on. And it's now, if you go over there, it's condos. And so one concern that a lot of media observers have in this merger is that the companies that are backing it are private equity firms. And typically and historically, private equity firms have had a habit or a pattern of wringing as much profit as they can out of newspapers or media companies and then reinvesting that those profits in other businesses that they think will make more money. And that usually involves that profitability involves cost cutting, which means fewer journalists, which means fewer people on the street, which means less coverage. And news coverage in a local community can get diminished. So that's one of my fears in this merger.
Do you sort of bring that brick around with you as a reminder? Like you just carry it around in your bag?
It's in my office. Yeah.
and we've seen that too, right? I mean, there a lot of newspapers have sort of had to cut back and try and find ways to economize, and that's meant
you know, fewer reporters to cover things like City Hall, local government, stuff that makes a difference to people, but we might not know so much about what's going on because there are fewer reporters out there on the job every day covering that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it goes the bigger picture beyond, you know, the story of this merger is local newspapers are a civic asset and they're an asset of democracy. And I know that sounds highfalutin and you know, philosophical, but it's true. I mean, the central purpose of a newspaper or any news organization is to serve as a watchdog on local government. And if you, and you know, more and more communities where there is no longer a local newspaper or that's covered by what we call a ghost newspaper, you know, a thin newspaper with content that's shared across these leveraged properties, as Sarah mentioned, you know, they're full of stories from far-flung areas that may not necessarily interest or be relevant to that local reader. So, mm-hmm. you know, this can be problematic.
Rick Edmonds, it's probably worth mentioning, too, that in some ways, you know, the news business, the newspaper business at least, hasn't been around that long in the grand scheme of things. If you think about USA Today, one of the Gannett newspapers, I guess the biggest one, that was only created in, what, the early 80s? Just fill us in a little bit.
1982, yes, it started.
Yeah, so, I mean, and you know, people know that newspaper, obviously. You'll often see it kind of poked under your door if you're staying in a hotel. That'll be the newspaper you sort of wake up to in the morning. What do you think this merger means for what people might be seeing in their newspapers in the near future?
Well, I agree with the other panelists. I think Gannett and Gatehouse are both typically made newspapers smaller. I mean, I think most newspapers are smaller than they used to be, with the exception of the big national papers. And there is some tendency to, I guess you'd say, fudge a little bit and treat some regional stories that may not be of a lot of local interest as the local news portion, and some of the accountability reporting on City Hall and those kinds of things may be going by the wayside. So it's concerning. I don't know that you would say this is a tremendous change for these papers, because they've all been part of a big chain. Now they're part of a even bigger chain.
Mm-hmm. In your reporting this week, you quoted Mike Reed, chairman and CEO of Gatehouse parent company New Media Investment Group. He said, quote, "We believe this transaction will create value for our shareholders, greater opportunities for our employees, and a stronger future for journalism." I mean, I guess, you know, CEOs, the people at the top of the tree, will also always say something like that when they're talking about a big change. Is he right?
Yeah,
is this a stronger future?
I've spoken to Mike Reed a number of times. He's actually fairly accessible to business media. But one time we were talking about unions, and he said, you know, "I'm trying to convince these folks that we're making changes now that will ensure that they have a job in 5 years." And, I mean, I think that's a reasonable point. If newspapers don't do a variety of things to strengthen their business model, consolidation is one of them, the situation is going to be, you know, really much worse in 5 years than it is right now.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Fisher with Axios, what's the competition to newspapers? Because I guess what they're trying to do is find a way around the challenge of declining ad revenue. You know, competition from online media has been a threat to newspapers in the last decade or more. So does a merger like this, do you think, is it enough to save both of these companies?
It's tough to say. I mean, I think the way that most people are looking at it is it's enough to slow what looks like an inevitable decline. I mean, at the end of the day, newspapers have been threatened by the internet for a long time. It's not just Google and Facebook. People look all the way back to even Craigslist when classifieds moved over to the internet. And I think that if you are going to combine a bunch of newspaper entities and you're going to, you know, sort of slash costs in order to make them more profitable, you're not really talking about areas to drive growth. You're not talking about ways to make these companies, you know, even more powerful, or even investing in new streams of revenue that could potentially pull them out of the advertising loss. And that's my biggest concern here. There are, however, a lot of efforts being made to figure out ways that there could be a local business model for local media that would help these newspapers compete with big tech companies like Google and Facebook for ad revenue, but also, mm-hmm. quite frankly, for time and attention. So there's a lot of efforts right now around the country. Nonprofits are investing in creating better subscription options for local newspapers. We've talked to local news companies that are trying to invest in selling local services, like calendars for local events. The big question here, though, is will any of it be enough? And the hope is that something will be enough, because as we're seeing, you mentioned earlier, there's less state house, courthouse reporters, there's less state reporters. We're finding reporting that says without that level of accountability, local governments are actually less efficient. They're spending more on things that they shouldn't be spending. And oftentimes it's because the Fourth Estate helps them sort of check their power, check their purse. So right now, there's a lot of threats to the business model of local media, but the hope is that, you know, something other than just consolidation will help keep the local media ecosystem alive.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News, talking about the big merger between Gatehouse Media and Gannett that was announced this week and what that means for news consumers, news producers in the state of Florida particularly. You can reach out to us. We're 1-866-338-5252. Are you still a newspaper reader, or do you prefer to get your news online or from TV or radio even? 1-866-338-5252. What do you think of this merger? You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. So, Rick Brunson, given the fact that you now have, you know, the majority of newspapers in Florida, you know, under the umbrella of one organization, what does that mean?
Consolidation, I think, scares a lot of people in an audience because they worry about corporate ownership, and does that make the product more vanilla, or are there stories that aren't being covered because of some kind of corporate interest? That may be one fear. The thing that I worry about is, there's been a 60% reduction in just the number of journalists at newspapers since 1990. And, Mike Reed in his conference call said that he's going to try to keep more feet on the street through this merger. And I hope that happens. Because as Sarah and as Rick mentioned, good, local, vigorous watchdog reporting is crucial to a community. We at UCF got a grant, a generous grant from the TECO Foundation a couple of years ago, and partnered with the Orlando Sentinel to put student journalists in some local communities where there wasn't a reporter. And one of the reporters, Abigail Brashear, one of the students who covered Oviedo, said prior to her, there wasn't a reporter at the Oviedo City Council meeting. And there's a marked difference in the way government leaders behave if there is a presence of the media there, of a reporter. And so it makes me wonder and makes me question, how do governments and government leaders behave when there isn't a media present there to watch what they're doing, to check on how they're spending taxpayer money? And that's what we're losing with the diminishment of newspapers. Newspapers do best, among all the media, because they have a beat structure. What they do best is they have a beat structure where you have an embedded reporter in a community who's there all the time, and that's what we're losing. And I think that's dangerous to democracy.
Rick Edmonds, sometimes or oftentimes, the city newspaper or the town newspaper, even the kind of regional newspaper is like the originator of stories, right? I feel like a lot of times in the media ecosystem, other media outlets, because newspapers have traditionally had more journalists on the job to cover those stories, they'll kind of use the newspaper as source material for ideas and things to cover, like television stations, radio stations, etc. So with a kind of a shrinking of newspapers, is that model going to change, do you think? Are we looking to other media outlets to sort of be the feet on the street reporters from here on out?
Well, there's some possibility of that. There have been startups of quite a few, usually philanthropically funded online-only news sources. Some of them, like the Texas Tribune, are really terrific. A lot of them are pretty small. So that's one possibility. I was going to mention, after the earlier conversation, that Pew and some other research indicate that at least as many or a few more people prefer to get their news from local television. But that may be fairly limited, you know, like they're interested in weather, especially traffic. So, I agree that the job that a good newspaper or even, you know, a smaller newspaper with a presence in a community does is a little bit the last line of defense against corruption. Actually, David Simon, the former reporter and creator of The Wire, testified about a decade ago to Congress that as this progresses, it's going to be a golden age of corruption in the United States. And I think that was a pretty good forecast.
That's kind of scary. Sarah Fisher, what do you make of that? And I'm wondering if, you know, new media outlets, like the one you work for example, are they, you know, so well positioned to sort of pick up the torch and really dig in and cover the stories that in the past local newspapers might have been covering?
I'm going to argue no. I think that our focus as a news site has really mostly been on trade news. So, you know, businesses writing for their businesses, or it's been on national news. But we don't have reporters on the ground covering town halls, covering municipalities. And that's because that's not our business. It's just not what we were created to do. And I think that there's such a value. And to Rick's point about what Mike Reed said, just keeping more feet on the ground, there's such a value in having feet on the ground. But some of the efforts that have been made, you see the big tech companies, Google and Facebook, they're pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into local initiatives, you know, to try to salvage the industry. You know, Google is partnering with McClatchy to build a local little news site in areas like, I think they're building one in Ohio where the Vindicator used to be. They're now building a little website in Youngstown. I don't think that's going to fill the vacancy of the thousands of papers that are either going to get cut, have been cut, or are moving from being dailies to weeklies, although I do think the effort is notable. I think the only way that you're really going to find a sustainable replacement to local newspapers is if we find a sustainable business model for local news, and we just haven't been able to crack it quite yet.
Do you get the sense that a solution is around the corner, though? Because it sort of feels in some ways that time might be running out, especially for more traditional media.
Well, here's what I do know. When you look at the data from these big tech platforms, Google, Facebook, Twitter, what have you, what they're noticing is that people do really sort of galvanize around community. They don't necessarily want to be talking about big national issues all the time. They actually want to be talking about things that pertain to the people that are physically closest to them. So what we do know is that maybe there's not yet a business model, but there is a consumer need. And just in larger economics, when there is a consumer need, you know, the market tends to follow. It hasn't happened yet for local news, but I hope that it will, because clearly there's an appetite for people learning about events near them, their local government, things to do in their neighborhoods. There's one local company called Patch. They kind of, you know, do local syndicated news, but they also have people on the ground. And they're starting to make all of their money by selling access to local calendars. And those local calendars can be everything from community events to PTA meetings at your school. They found that the average person's paying around $50 a month because they don't just want to get a calendar for their school, but they want to get a calendar for ballet lessons and whatever have you. And then there's news that comes with it. That sounds very promising to me because it's something that a big, you know, national player could never really be able to dive deep in and do right.
We're talking about the merger of Gatehouse and Gannett on 90.7's Intersection. You can reach out to us with your thoughts on what this merger means for news consumers like yourselves and also for producers. We're at WMFE Orlando on Twitter. Your questions and comments there. Rick Brunson, your thoughts on what Sarah's point was about this kind of potential new markets or new models for local news.
Yeah, her point, I really like her point about the appetite there for hyper-local news. Pew Research put out a survey not too long ago where they polled Americans and found that 71% of Americans believe that local news outlets are actually doing very well financially. and so
wow.
There's a huge disconnect.
Where are they getting their information
from?
There's
a huge disconnect between what they perceive and what the reality is. And the survey showed that only 14% of Americans are paying for local news. And I think that's the pinch that local newspapers are in, is at the time when their staffs are being, you know, drastically cut back, they're also being asked to produce a digital product that people are willing to pay for. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to pay for it if they don't perceive that there's quality and value in that coverage. So newspapers are in a pinch. You know, they're having to transform themselves into digital first, you know, organizations. At the same time, they have fewer people. Mm-hmm. And those people, I mean, I was having a conversation with an editor the other day. I'm training my student journalist to become like Dr. Octavius in the Spider-Man series. You have, you know, all these tentacles coming out of you. You're expected to shoot video, edit video, capture audio, write, you know, a 600-word narrative, and do all of these things at a high level of quality to keep all of those digital mouths and platforms fed. Mm-hmm. And it's tough to do.
Are they still lining up and taking journalism courses, though?
We are. Our classes remain full, and they're very hopeful. Even though, you know, their parents say that they're scared for their career choice, and they get a lot of negative pushback, but they're showing up to take these classes because they believe in the mission of journalism.
Mm-hmm. Rick Edmonds, is there always going to be a place for physical printed newspapers, do you think, or is that model just inevitably going to disappear at some point?
Well, I think at some point, but I think it's a very lively question, how soon, and I've been doing this a long time. There have been naysayers saying they'll all be flipped to digital for a decade or more now. I think we may see pulling back of frequency, and we definitely will see a pattern of Sunday newspapers only before newspapers in print fold up entirely. But I'm going to say 5 to 10 years maybe. Maybe the best guess for that. It's very hard, though, to predict far into the future. And, you know, if you think back, the troubles began for newspapers in the 2000s, and Facebook didn't even exist for part of that period. So there are new things coming along all the time, and there is some progress in newspapers selling digital subscriptions, figuring out what people in their communities want, finding some other sources of income. So I don't think it's a hopeless situation, but I mean, I got to say, I can't predict a brighter future or see an obvious business model. To Sarah's point, that people have been working on this for a long time, it's not super clear how that can be managed.
Right, and part of the cost cutting often involves like selling off a printing press, right, as happened at the Orlando Sentinel and other papers.
Yeah, selling off a printing press, selling a building, the sort of old-fashioned newspaper building downtown, isn't really needed anymore. So, yeah, that helps some, but that in itself is not probably sufficient. You got to have a basic business that works for the audience, increasing the audience will pay, and for some advertisers who are sticking around and see some virtue. Maybe if, quickly I could mention one more thing, that an opportunity for media, including local media, is the troubles that Facebook and Google are having with privacy questions and also advertising, that, you know, your ad might be running against hate speech or something like that. So a quality environment, which has always been an element of newspapers in their glory years, I think that's still there, and I think that's a business asset.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, challenging times for the newspaper business indeed, and probably some kind of questions ahead for folks who work in that industry in Florida especially over the next few months. Well, Rick Edmonds is a media business analyst with Pointer. Thank you so much for joining us, Rick.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
We're also joined by Sarah Fisher. She's a media reporter with Axios. Sarah, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
And Rick Brunson, Associate Instructor of Journalism at UCF. Rick, thank you too.
Thank you for having me.
Well, coming up next, we are sticking with media for a little bit, talking about El Paso and what is happening on the border there, grappling with the trauma of last week's mass shooting, and at the centre of a nationwide debate over gun control. We'll speak to a reporter who's covering the story about how the community there is responding to the tragedy. That's up next when Intersection returns.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. El Paso residents are grieving. The town on the border of Texas and Mexico was one of two communities hit by mass shootings last weekend. A gunman opened fire in a Walmart in El Paso on Saturday, killing 22 people and injuring dozens more. Less than 24 hours later, 9 people were killed and 27 injured by a shooter in Dayton, Ohio. The tragedy in El Paso has deeply affected residents just across the border, too. Yesterday, I spoke with Lauren Villagran, she's a border reporter with the El Paso Times and the USA Today Network, about how the community has responded to the shooting. Lauren Villagran, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
So, how are people coping nearly a week on from the shooting?
Well, I think, suffice to say, there's just an immense amount of sadness and sorrow, and I'd say also percolating anger in the community in the wake of the shooting that killed so many.
Is there a consistent theme to who they're directing their anger towards, or are people kind of reaching different conclusions there?
I mean, you know, I certainly can't speak for everyone in the community, but I attended protests against President Trump's visit to El Paso yesterday, and what you heard over and over again was people connecting the president's rhetoric on immigrants and immigration to some of the, you know, alleged ideology that the suspected shooter, you know, justified his actions with. And so I think that there is, underneath the sadness and the mourning that people are experiencing right now, anger at both the president and maybe also at lawmakers who some say haven't done enough regarding gun control. The president certainly has a broad base of support in parts of El Paso. You didn't see so much of that yesterday because the focus was really on the victims and survivors and their families.
So obviously the president's visit was very highly publicized, and a lot's been written and spoken about that across the United States. But what about other lawmakers? Have you been seeing them make appearances, and what have you heard from them?
Well, our Congresswoman, U.S. Representative Veronica Escobar, declined to meet with the president yesterday and instead attended a protest and vigil at a nearby park. Several hundred people were there. You know, it was over 100 degrees. And she spoke, and as well as presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke, other local lawmakers were there as well. And more than politics, I think the message was one of unity and solidarity in mourning, both for, you know, the El Paso community, but also Ciudad Juarez, which is, you know, our sister city, and we really sort of live out that border community as one.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for our listeners in Florida who may not be familiar with El Paso, I wonder if you could just paint us a little picture of what it's like there. It seems like it's a town where it really depends, you know, the economy of the town really depends on sort of flow of people, you know, to the extent it's possible across the border, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is hard to grasp for people who don't live on the border, but, you know, El Paso is in West Texas, and the borderline sort of cuts a seam between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, and every day tens of thousands of people across the border legally for work, for school, to visit family and friends. A recent survey showed that nearly 50% of El Pasoans lived the first formative years of their life in Mexico. This is a city that's 83% Hispanic and, you know, shares both familial, cultural, often linguistic ties with Ciudad Juarez. So, it's a very tight-knit community.
And do you get the sense that the shooting is going to have some kind of lasting impact on those two communities and kind of how they interact with each other, El Paso and Juarez?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I don't know how to answer that. You know, I can tell you that Ciudad Juarez lived through a period of extreme violence several years ago, and that certainly has had a lasting impact on the community, in some ways negative, because there are still people in El Paso who stopped traveling south of the border during that period of violence and never went back to going back to visit Juarez. Will this mass shooting at a Walmart change the habits of people who live in Juarez, who were accustomed to coming north for shopping or, you know, to visit family? I don't have a good answer for that right now. I can tell you that just a couple of days, you know, after the shooting, even as soon as Sunday, the bridges were full. People were coming to do their shopping. They were worried. Some, you know, were anxious. But, you know, I don't think it's going to be a massive shift in the way people interact. But it is a good question. I mean, it was not just it wasn't just the number of victims, but also sort of the symbolic nature and the targeting of this border community that I think really hit people hard here.
Mm-hmm. What have you been learning, Lauren, about the victims, those who died in the shooting, those who survived and their families too?
Well, I did just speak with someone who was at the Walmart during the shooting and who helped carry the wounded out. And, you know, I think that there's, you know, people are still in shock, you know, and just dealing with the loss. There is a large memorial that has kind of popped up near the Walmart, the site of the shooting. And I know that many, many people have been passing through to lay flowers, light candles, share a prayer. So, you know, I can just say the community is mourning, you know, each in his or her own way.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the sentiment around the visit of President Trump. It sounds like immigration is at the forefront of people's minds right now. What about gun control? Is that something you hear people talk a lot about, at least the folks you've talked to?
Yeah, it was interesting that the people who spoke at the protest, including lawmakers, didn't make that the central issue. But when you talk to protesters and people who had arrived, you know, just to attend and, you know, and share their grief and anger, guns did come up. And what I heard over and over again was people want a ban on assault weapons. I didn't hear anyone say, you know, take away everybody's guns. Or all the guns, but there was a definite kind of cohesion around this idea that people shouldn't have access to high-powered automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm. In the immediate aftermath of the shooting, we saw photographs, we saw video, you know, and media outlets of people lined up around the block to donate blood. How else has the community come together to help folks who are affected?
Oh, my goodness. I haven't been on the story, so I can't give you exact numbers, but hundreds of thousands of dollars have been donated. I mean, just a few days, an immense amount of money has poured in that will be, you know, distributed in different ways to both organizations who might be aiding victims and also to, you know, survivors and their families. It's just been an incredible outpouring of support from local businesses and, you know, just regular folks.
These stories can be pretty tricky to cover, and especially when you're reporting on your own community, right? I'm just wondering how the El Paso Times newsroom is coping.
Well, I can say that, you know, I'm grateful to work for the El Paso Times, which is a newsroom that belongs to Gannett. They have sent in reinforcements from our newspapers around the country, so we've had a lot of help. I'd also like to send a shout out to all of the newsrooms around the country who have been sending us food. We've had breakfast, lunch, and dinner ordered in from places like the New York Times and Austin American Statesman and newspapers all around. Our journalists have been working nonstop since Saturday, you know, some for days on end with very little sleep. But this is, you know, this is important to us. It's important to help communicate, you know, as much information as possible, and both to understand what happened and to help the community, you know, sort of process and move forward.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the focus is going to be for the community, for lawmakers locally in the next kind of week or so?
You know, I know that the funerals have already begun. So there's very much still a very long process ahead of mourning those who were lost.
Well, Lauren Villagran covers the border for the El Paso Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection, new music from Amy Robbins. We're back in a minute.
There's still some things weighing on your chest. You gotta unload it so you can feel your best. Keep playing all those.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Lake County-based singer-songwriter Amy Robbins released an album earlier this year. The album's called Maple Sparrow, which was the name of her previous musical project. Robbins is performing under her own name now. She says naming her album Maple Sparrow was a way to bookend that part of her career and signal a new direction. She joined us in the studio to perform and talk about her music, beginning with a song called Make It Big.
Small town living never felt so good. You were the brightest star in the neighborhood. And everywhere you go, you play those whiskey-soaking songs, hoping that they would sing along. Maybe it'll move this whole thing along. Maybe then I'd live up to the words I sing in my songs. You're gonna make it, trust me. You're gonna make it big. And all those girls are gonna scream and shout when they see you on TV. Yeah, all those girls are gonna scream and shout when they see you on TV. Drinking your way all across the land and getting this town in the palm of your hand. Crying about the world and how it's dark and trouble-bound. Well, that voice inside you never screams so loud. You gotta do it right, gotta do it right now. Time has come for you to stand up and rise from the crowd. You're gonna make it, trust me. You're gonna make it big. And all those girls are gonna scream and shout when they see you on TV. Yeah, all those girls are gonna scream and shout when they see you on TV. There's still some things weighing on your chest. You gotta unload it so you can feel your best. Keep playing all those whiskey-soaking songs, hoping that they would sing along. Maybe it'll move this whole thing along. Maybe then you'll live up to the words you sing in your songs. You're gonna make it, trust me. You're gonna make it big. And all those girls are gonna scream and shout when they see you on TV. Yeah, you're gonna make it, trust me. You're gonna make it big. And all those girls are gonna scream and shout when they see you on TV. Yeah, all those girls are gonna scream and shout when they see you on TV. Yeah, all those girls are gonna scream and shout when they see you on TV.
Well, Amy Robbins, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome back to Intersection. The new album is Maple Sparrow.
That's right, Maple Sparrow.
Also the name of the band you perform with, or your performing stage name, I guess.
It was. I actually decided to ditch the name Maple Sparrow and go for my real name, Amy Robbins. Mm-hmm. So as a way to kind of close the door on that, I thought naming the album Maple Sparrow would be a good way to move on. And plus, if somebody like Googles Maple Sparrow, it still comes up as me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought that was a good little way to put a bow on it. You know?
So that's the end of that particular project?
It is.
What does that mean for you musically then? What sort of new direction are you heading in?
I think I'm going in a more like folky, indie type of route than I was going before. I was mainly focusing on the country genre,
mm-hmm.
which obviously I still have a lot of that in my influences, but it's kind of just like a way of being like, okay, I'm independently doing this. This is my solo project, and you know, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just whatever I want it to be.
So you perform with some other groups as well?
I do. I play with Swamp Sisters. It's one of the main ones that I perform with. And in that band, I do the guitar and I do bass, and we all sing and work on songs together. And
mm-hmm.
actually, the song that I just played, Make It Big, is a song that I wrote off of a songwriting challenge from the Swamp Sisters, which is kind of something that Beth McKee is known for. She'll issue a phrase or a challenge like, okay, here's the word, have this ready in 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need that as a push to stay creative.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cool.
What about some of the lyrics in that song? Was this kind of a note to yourself? Were you writing it to somebody else?
You know, when I first wrote it, I thought that it was for someone else, but the more that I sing it, and I just think it was for me. Mm-hmm. It was accidentally autobiographical. And it's just about, you know, a small town musician who's always trying to get to that next step. And what can I do that's going to set me apart from the person who played here yesterday? Like, what is it that's about me that's going to get their attention? And sometimes mm-hmm. it's hard to figure that out.
Have you changed the way you approach that now? Like, are you now at the stage in your career where, like, are you still kind of chasing the bigger stage, or do you feel like your music can sort of take you in a direction where you don't have to worry too much about that?
I think that right now I'm trying to get away from the bar scene and move in the direction of festivals and bigger stages, so mm-hmm. to speak. And because, you know, for many, many years I've done the bar scene, and it gets tiring, and you're having to learn all these covers and stuff. So I think right now I'm in the position where I really want to focus on my originals and get my name out there for that, not the girl who covered Fleetwood Mac.
Mm-hmm. Are there some songs that you would never want to play again because you've played them so many times?
Oh, yeah. Four Non-Blondes, What's Up? You know that one.
Mm-hmm.
I've been playing that one my whole music career.
It's kind of a tough one to sing, though, right?
Yeah, I changed the key a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually kind of fun, though, because in a good crowded bar on the right night, you can bust that song out and everybody in the joint sings along.
Mm-hmm.
So it has its place, and it is fun.
When you do play a bar, like, how much of your own material can you put in there?
I honestly sneak in a lot of mine. I'll do, like, every other, like, two songs. I'll do two covers and then an original.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll try to feel out the crowd and see if they like it. And certain bars that I play at all the time, I know that they're okay with it. So it kind of just depends on the area and the venue that you're at and mm-hmm. what the people there are into.
And do you find that people are now asking for some of your original stuff amongst all the kind of covers that you have to play as well?
Yeah, definitely. And that's a really cool feeling to have an original requested. You're like, wow, you want to hear something that I wrote?
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. And is it a good sort of musical environment in the Lake County area?
Actually, it is. I've got a lot of friends there who are also musicians, and the problem with Lake County, I think, is that a lot of the residents, people in the area, the locals, aren't really that into the music. It's like they would be just as happy with a jukebox, something that they could go and even pick their own selections, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But as far as, like, other musicians go, there's actually quite a good network over there. Mm-hmm. And there are a few special little spots that we play at that people appreciate it and get into it, and the owners like it. And
mm-hmm.
and it's a growing area. Particularly downtown Leesburg is
right.
really trying to make a leap into a different direction. They're putting in a new craft brewery, which actually, I have to be honest, my brother is the master brewer of that, so it's a little push for him,
right.
Mammoth Oak Brewing, and that should be open in the next month or two. But among that, they're putting other restaurants and some other little, like, nightlife stuff, so they're trying to up their game a little bit.
Yeah, and I guess there's development there, right? I mean, Orlando is kind of spilling out into Lake County in some ways.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's growing all the time. I actually grew up there, and it is so much different than when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is because of the villages. They're just expanding everywhere.
Do you perform for that crowd, too? Or is that a specific audience?
It is a specific audience. I have performed there in the past. I worked there for a long time. I waited tables at a mm-hmm. restaurant over there called The Lighthouse, and I actually played at that same restaurant. That's kind of how I got my start doing the bar gig stuff,
because
mm-hmm. I was working there. They knew that I played music, and they said, hey, why don't you prepare 4 hours worth of music and mm-hmm. come play for us sometime? So I did, and that was fun. It is a specific type of crowd. They do want to hear things like Mustang Sally and things that they can dance to, things they mm-hmm. know the words to. So you kind of have to be prepared for that and know what you're getting into before you start playing over there.
You have to learn some Jimmy Buffett as well.
Absolutely. Margaritaville.
I guess that's anywhere you play in Florida, though, right?
Sure, yeah.
If you're playing covers. Well, tell me a little bit about the next song you want to perform for us, Amy.
The next song I'd like to perform for you is called Blame the Whiskey. And this is actually a song that is on my album that I just put out, on the Maple Sparrow album. So here's the acoustic version.
You were strung out on whiskey, and I was standing at the gate. You said that you'd miss me,
said, honey, that's your first mistake. Somewhere between sirens and sheets, lead promises my heart could never keep. You can learn to love yourself, put the bottle back on the shelf. Maybe then you wouldn't feel so alone and empty. Moon is high and whiskey flows, reddest eyes and whitest snow. You should have just broke up with me. In between the sirens and the sheets, late promises my lips could never keep. Should have just broke up with me while you had the chance. You could have just been the whiskey, no shot of straight romance. Should have just broke up with me, darling. And now you can't blame the whiskey. Driving south to Floral City, left me standing in the rain. Said you weren't going with me. I should learn to self-sustain. You say cheating hearts are all the same. Lies are dirty words all wrapped in vain. Promises my lips could never keep. Should have just broke up with me while you had the chance. Could have just been the whiskey. Should have just broke up with me, darling. Go on and blame the whiskey. I'm gonna blame the whiskey. Another shot of straight romance. You were strung out on whiskey, and I'm standing at the gate.
Well, Amy Robbins, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Robbins' new album is called Maple Sparrow. You can find a link with more details, including where she's performing next, on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Technical direction for today's show from Juan Gualda. Production assistance from Danielle Pryor. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.